Charles Abugre is the deputy director of the UN Millennium Campaign Africa. He's from Ghana and brings to the campaign over 20 years of anti-poverty campaigning and is leading intellectual from the African continent. He's lectured in the US and the UK and does a lot of presentations like this throughout the world.
I'd like to thank you very much for inviting me here and for all of you for coming, especially our members of parliament as well. I was last year, I think, in Canada in the late 1990s. I used to be an active part in the various processes of establishing Africa, Canada relationships and partnerships. And the last G8 meeting I attended in Canada was in Halifax. So I'm returning to Halifax after several years. That Halifax meeting was a reflection of the moods of the time. It was a time when there was unprecedented political spaces for citizens groups to participate in intergovernmental activities. I remember in Halifax, at that time we hadn't started running battles with the G8 yet in the most brutal ways. And a lot of civil society organizations participated, labor groups, faith-based groups, and it was quite an interesting time. So at that time you were all trying to look at how to shape the international financial institutions and the agenda of the international financial institutions. We had just come out of the, I think, the financial crisis in Moscow, in Brazil and in Russia. But then the mood for dealing with institutional change was quite high at that time. Those periods of the 1990s also were follow up to a series of UN supported conferences. You remember the conferences of the 1990s, the Copenhagen Conference on Social Development, the Cairo Population and Development Conference. We had just had a remarkable series of global events around the AF Summit. And then we had come out of the Beijing Conference and established the Beijing Platform for Action. These were the periods in which the world seemed to have pooling together to set up global norms. Mm-hmm. But there were also some of these norms were both a reflection of experiences, several decades of experiences in development generally, some good, some positive. You will recall that those of you who followed the Copenhagen Summit, the Copenhagen Summit on Social Development was basically a reflection of a global protest against structural adjustment programs. Structural adjustment programs that were not only hitting poor countries, but Canada had gone through its whole experience of structural adjustment programs. So there was a shared agenda that a certain liberalization, a certain way of organizing global economies was, wreaking havoc on the weakest part of society and breaking the norms of global solidarity globally. This is the context in which Beijing Platform for Action was created, as Copenhagen Social Action Agenda was generated, and so on. The Millennium Development Goals were in part a reflection, an outcome of these conferences of the 1990s. So if you look at bits and pieces all across the Millennium Development Goals, each one of them sort of dealt with some one agenda of the UN conferences of the 1990s. So, in a sense, they are a culmination of processes which were global. They carry norms and values that were shaped in the 1990s globally. But as you will know, the Millennium Development Goals are not without controversy, and they are not without fierce critiques. For a start, there is a view that the Millennium Development Goals, being more or less a copy of the international development targets of the OECD, was an attempt to undermine the more structural reform agenda arising out of Copenhagen Social Summit. The structural reform agendas was a rejection of structural adjustment and liberalization. The fact that we needed to organize society and economies differently, where human development was at the center, rather than the rights of capital. That the state had a strong role in the provision of healthcare, water, and regulating wages and ensuring full employment, rather than a market or an unregulated market. That the market played a role in providing social goods, but only when the state was active in regulating the market and in managing capital in a way that capital delivers, you know, for society. That the world could not create social justice unless you fundamentally changed the relationships within the power relationships between men and women. That the society could not globally be just unless you dealt with fundamental redistribution of wealth, both within countries and between countries. That we could not sustain the quality of life of humanity unless we dealt with nature more generously than we did, less extractively, more careful about preservation. These were the key messages that were coming out of the UN conferences of the 1990s. The Millennium Development Goals are, to some extent, reflective of only components of these, but not these fundamental structural issues of power. So most of us rejected the Millennium Development Goals as an attempt to blunt the criticisms of a world which is shaping unequally and destructively, of a world which was generating more rights for capital and less for labor and society. This criticism remains strong to date. A way in which this criticism is partly formulated is in what the goals did not at the beginning reflect. The goals for a long time did not reflect women's fight for many years for reproductive rights. It is only in not a couple of years ago that reproductive health and reproductive rights found themselves itself back onto the MDG's agenda. The goal did not reflect the struggle for full employment and decent work. Although the central thrust of Copenhagen and Beijing was full employment and decent work. It's only in a few years back again, after struggles by the international labor organizations and working people's organizations around the world, that full employment and decent work found itself back onto the MDGs. So in a sense, the MDGs are only slowly reflecting some of the fundamental concerns of those who were struggling for equality and social justice since reflective of the conferences of the 1990s. Therefore, the social justice movement, the environment movement, became split around the MDGs. You could say the attempt to address these gaps goes one step forward in attempting to bring the different actors in social justice together around the agenda of development. There is another critique, which is that MDG 1 in particular is generally a very retrogressive MDG. In this, for two reasons. One is attempting to accept a norm of survival, of what represents reasonable, decent living around $1 or $1.25 with recent revisions a day, when we know that in fact an attempt even in the poorest country to survive on a by a family unit of three on a $1.25 a day actually represents desperation survival levels of life. So normatively, there is a problem in accepting that as a way of measuring human progress. But there's another thing, which is that because MDG-1 rejected employment for a long time and full employment, the means by which people will lift themselves out of indignity or poverty basically then depended on transfers. And if a government, by being poor, is unable to do domestic transfers to its poorest people to survive, then the transfers only happen internationally, which is why aid became the central focus of MDG 8. Which meant that MDG 1 was attempting to maintain the status quo of an unequal world where economic transformation and equity was not part of the global agenda. So to date, there are no measures of equity, whether internally, in terms of intra-country equality measures, or internationally. That remains a missing element. Therefore, people would say MDG 1 was attempting to prevent structural from transformation in the global economy that allowed for poorest countries to pull themselves out of poverty. It allows it to be formulated in such a way that you will then have MDG 8 sustain the status quo. Now, what is MDG 8? MDG 8 is formulated almost as if the rich world's responsibility is simply to do some token support for the poor world. So you provide aid. So 0.7%, if you got there, became the marker. But it is not obligatory. There are no serious mechanisms of mutual accountability. So it is voluntary. There's accountability only to the extent that there is political pressure amongst organizations in the countries of the rich economies to hold governments to account. Otherwise, there is no mechanism in the international aid system for the other side to hold to account the commitment to 0.7. Whereas the aid system organizes itself for those who provide aid to constantly hold the receivers to account in various complicated mechanisms of the aid agenda, the recent being direct budget support. So it sustains an unequal balance of power in the relationship as if it was not a global compact in which both had obligations. Then the other part of MDG 8 is about trade. But in trade, the focus is on market access. And this may well be good for middle-income economies. So MDG 8 market access is great for an economy that is attempting to produce value-added goods and needs to be a market of more wealthy income consumers to purchase value-added goods. Because value-added goods is the area in which tariffs and non-tariff barriers are highest. But it's also the mechanism by which economies are transformed, where jobs are provided. Unfortunately, that is also not sufficient. It only, for middle-income countries, that MDG 8 is secured only when there is an international enforceable agreement. And the WTO was a mechanism for that. But anybody that has followed the various negotiations in the WTO would recognize that that level of benevolence and international commitment was not forthcoming, which is one of the reasons why the negotiations have stalled. But for the poorest countries, market access is effectively a useless offer, because primary commodities have no market access problems. So those whose economies are dominated by the production of primary commodities already have, in the case of the European Union, everything but arms. But primary commodities have zero tariffs. The area of trade policy most important for poorest countries is the right to protect, which is how to prevent market penetration to a level in which the ability to produce value-added goods is undermined. But the right to protect is not recognized either in the MDGs or anywhere else. So we have had this fundamental lopsided arrangement within the MDGs. All of this is to say the MDGs are not without controversy, and they are not perfect. They still offer a lot of room for campaigning and struggles to move the normative agenda forward. Having said so, the MDGs have made very positive contributions to international development. First and foremost, this is the first time that the agenda of development is formulated in this more holistic human development-oriented focus, the type of thing that Amartya Sen and those of us who have been working in international development have been pushing, that you cannot think about development simply as economic growth. You have to think about the poorest people's access to healthcare, water, protection, child survival, and women's survival. In that sense, it is a norm worth protecting. Well and over above 2015. In the case of sub-Saharan Africa in particular, the MDGs have led to a major reversal of policy. You will recall that most of the demonstrations of the 1980s and 1990s were against user fees in healthcare and education. The view that the state's fundamental role is not necessarily to directly provide healthcare, water, and education, but to enable the market to provide. The view that those countries develop only when you prioritize stable macroeconomies, which means low inflation, which means low government expenditure. And this low government expenditure actually led to the introduction of user fees, which then drove away the poor access to healthcare, education, and decent water. Exactly. MDGs reversed that. We no more have upfront this debate that says that the government does not need to build schools. You have to create an enabling environment for the private sector to build schools. We've made a lot of progress. We reversed the education thing. We have not fundamentally reversed the policy on healthcare. Nevertheless, there has been major progress on HIV/AIDS management. Now nearly 2 million people have access to antiretroviral drugs. There's a major progress that's made in the management of malaria. There's been major progress that's made, you know, in the management of other communicable diseases. There is a reversal. So the downward trend in terms of the increasing marginalization of poor people for healthcare, education, water access has been reversed. So one has to judge the MDGs and say Africa's progress, Africa and South Asia's progress in the MDGs, not simply in terms of whether they would reach them, but from the low deaths from which they have emerged after nearly 20 years of structural adjustment programs. In that sense, the progress is quite interesting. There was also a period in which even the $1.25 a day, there is a debate as to whether Africa will meet that 2015 target of cutting $1 a day poverty by half or not. The agreement is that most, as a whole, they will not. Although there is alternative research that says, but for the financial crisis, they would reach that $1.25 a day halving of poverty by the year 2017. It doesn't matter whether it is 2015, 2017, 2018, or 2019, as long as the trend is towards a greater reduction of poverty. Right. In that sense, it is important to sustain the focus on the reduction of poverty. And the question of what needs to be done to radically reduce poverty in Asia, in South Asia and Africa should remain the focus. Without it, we move to something else. We move back to the debate about economic growth, as if economic growth per se, without measures that target, that channel the benefits of economic development to poor people through jobs, through transfers, through the provision of healthcare, through support to agriculture, so that growth is broad-based. Without that support, growth does not necessarily generate poverty reduction in a significant way. I know there's a lot of debate among economists about this, but this is very clear in that sense. We have to sustain the pressure on that. Secondly, even maternal mortality, the worst performing MDG in Africa and South Asia, recent research does suggest that there has been more progress than we have been estimating. We have been estimating that globally, on average, 500,000 women die from childbirth. Recent work by Lancet, published in Lancet, suggests that this figure is much lower and is on the downward trend. Nevertheless, the situation is quite bad. What is it that generates, you know, increasing deaths by women, and it's mostly young women? Well, it's several things, including the collapse of health systems. That although we have improved health performance by targeting specific diseases, we haven't quite addressed health systems. And when the health systems are not functioning, and the WHO's cry for a focus on primary health care and the public health system is not functioning and abandoned, you have patchy progress. And so the system is unable to provide support for pregnant women. Then it's also nutrition. Recent research suggests that up to 20% of deaths of maternal deaths are as a result of nutrition-related causes. This has to do with the crisis of small-scale agriculture, both in South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. It tells us, and including the lessons we have learned from recent price increases in food prices, it tells us that we cannot fundamentally achieve the MDGs unless we address the question of access to food and access to nutritious food, and that is investment in agriculture, and small-scale agriculture in particular. There is also the issue of access to safe termination of pregnancies. Now, I know this is a controversial debate everywhere. I'm coming from Kenya, and our constitutional debate is being held hostage around a debate on a very carefully formulated, you know, exceptionalist clause on safe abortion. We think the constitution will pass. It's a very useful debate. But we did a piece of research in Ghana two years ago, and we found that between 15 and 18%, that's a conservative estimate, of death by young women attempting to give birth is as a result of unsafe abortion. There's a group called Alliance for Reproductive Health Rights in Ghana that did a fantastic documentary, which has been airing in Ghanaian television in the past couple of weeks. And it shows just the crudest and most terrible ways in which young women terminate pregnancies. It is a thing we have to deal with. And then there is, of course, the ability to choose whether to become pregnant or not, which is the supply of reproductive health services generally. We have to address these issues fundamentally. Therefore, although Canada very admirably is adding up to other countries in wanting to take on and support progress in the maternal mortality issue, it is impossible to deal with maternal mortality as a separate issue, separate from reproductive health rights, the ability of women to be able to feed themselves and feed themselves decently, nutritious food, and paid work, and the transformation of agriculture. So a good step by Canadian government, but then it has to be interpreted that a commitment to reducing maternal and child deaths actually means a commitment to entire MDGs because of the interrelated nature between maternal deaths and the rest of the MDGs. Now, to conclude, we have made progress. The progress has been held back quite badly by the financial crisis in the last year. There's a recent report published by the IMF and World Bank, one of their better reports, which they launched, I think, 2 days ago, which is the MDGs update, in which they explain the potential impact of the financial crisis in the MDGs and the reversal of gains. It is very well worth reading. What it says is that it is probably going to prevent up to 64 million people between now and the 2015 being lifted out of poverty as a result of the crisis. several hundred thousands of women and children will die as a result of the financial crisis. What it says is that we need to take extraordinary measures. One extraordinary measure is that the international community, especially the rich world, have to provide compensatory measures. One of the good things that have happened, even in the poorest countries, including Africa, during the financial crisis, is that they did their best, most governments, to contain the crisis. As a result, growth will rebound. As a result of the continuous consumption of primary commodities by China, GDP growth will pick up again and commodity prices will pick up again. But the losses as a result of the financial crisis are steep. This is not the result of poor countries. This is a particular setback which is the result of the failure of the institutions that are responsible for regulating global finance. That includes the G8 that set up the international, the various, and control the various institutions for regulating international finance. It is as if that is the reasons why compensatory measures have to be provided by the rich countries. It is not as if they were doing the poor countries necessarily a favor. It is that the failure of international regulation, especially by the rich countries, have created a cost, you know, for poor people around the world, to which international responsibility suggests that those who had responsibility do take responsibility. Secondly, it also requires thinking differently about how we channel resources. And that includes, you know, focusing on areas we have missed in the past, including transfers and social security systems. But social security systems cannot endure if we do not make decent work and employment actually happen in the poorest countries, which are the sources of revenues to which governments can make transfers other than international aid. So the question of decent work as a central, most, one of the most important focus on MDGs for the poorest countries is something that, especially in Africa, we'll be calling on partners to support, to put decent work at the center of the table. Mm-hmm. Finally, I think you should, Canada in particular, whatever the shade of government at the moment, must recognize that it has had an international image and responsibility for international development historically. It has generally been a positive agenda. It has to continue to be a positive agenda. International development is a learning process. A focus on one particular thing may be good if it offers a chance to learn about other things. The MDGs are an important and useful agenda to focus international development in the coming years. Thank you, and sorry for going past my 30 minutes. Oh, man.